Let's call the meeting to order. This is Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. It's February 24th, or excuse me, 26th, 2009. It's approximately 1:37. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. To my left is Senator Bundy and Senator Davis. To my right is Senator Thomas and myself, Senator Pascvan. Senator Meyer will be a little bit late. He expects to be here in 20, 25 minutes or so. Anyway, what I would ask everyone, please turn off your cell phones. Don't put them on vibrate because it does interfere with the recording equipment. And so please turn them off. The purpose of the meeting today is to take up two pieces of legislation. The first piece of legislation will be finishing up on Senate Bill 84, and that relates to ADA bonding limits and confidentiality. We had a hearing on that just a couple of days ago. And then Senate Bill 23 relating to restoring the defined benefit retirement system. Thank you to those in attendance here and those off-site participating as well. We will first discuss an amendment to Senate Bill 84, and I understand Mr. Leonard from ADA and the AG's office are available to answer questions about Senate Bill 84, and I do intend to move that bill out of Senate Labor and Commerce after a short discussion, and then after that we will move to Senate Bill 23, and the bill sponsor through his staff will be presenting a committee substitute to Senate Bill 23. And then I've also asked through invited testimony through a Beth Almeida, who is the executive director of the National Institute on Retirement Security, who will be phoning in from Washington, D.C., for her to provide us with a presentation. And I believe we had a packet for distribution to those so that they will be able to follow Beth Almeida in that. And then we also have a fiscal note that has, I think, literally hot off the press from the administration, Mr. Shire and Mr. Brooks. Anyway, after those presentations, it is my hope with the, based on the intent of the committee, to move Senate Bill 23 from Labor and Commerce today. But with that in mind, we will begin, Senator Thomas, with respect to taking up Senate Bill 83. Or excuse me, 84, the ADA bonding.
Okay.
Excuse me, 84.
Say, no, I'm not ready for that one. But, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have the bill before us, do we, or not, or do we need to bring it before us?
I believe we had Senate Bill 84 before us last. Yes.
Without,
yeah. Yes, okay. So
just the amendment. I would offer amendment number one, which, as you already mentioned, Ted Leonard is available to testify and explain that if there is any need for explanation. So I would bring forward amendment number one. Everybody got it?
Hey, Senator Bundy?
Yeah, just perhaps for the public's understanding, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, this would simply put a sunset date on the bill.
That's correct. It's to put a five-year sunset date rather than it being in perpetuity as the language exists now.
Thank you.
Okay. No other questions.
Any other objections or questions? The amendment number one is before us, and Mr. Leonard, would you please, I understand telephonically you're off-site, and would you please make...
Yes, Chairman Pascvan.
All right, thank you. Would you please identify yourself and your affiliation?
Yes, I am Ted Leonard, the Executive Director of Alaska Industrial and Development and Export Authority.
All right, and, you know, there was a question raised at the last hearing with respect to whether the authority should continue in perpetuity as compared to having, for example, a five-year sunset, and this amendment does incorporate a five-year sunset, and what are your thoughts on that?
Chairman Pascvan, I think... we can definitely understand the legislators' concerns about oversight, and based on the wording that has been placed before us, that it does include the refunding bond language that we believe is necessary for us to get the best rates that we can for ourselves and businesses, so that we're fine with the language that Senator Myers has proposed.
Any further questions of Mr. Leonard? Yes, Mr. Thomas. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure, Ted, that our understanding is correct here, refunding bond is exactly what it says and the way it was described before, that it's like refinancing your home. So it pertains to to bonding regarding the same project or facility or whatever, rebonding that to actually decrease, obviously, hopefully, the rate. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Senator Thomas, yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee of Mr. Leonard? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Leonard. I know the Attorney General's office was prepared. If there were any questions of the committee, are there any questions of the Attorney General's office by anyone on the committee? Seeing no questions, I believe we would have Senate Bill 84 as amended by Amendment 1. Is that before us at the moment? And
Mr. Chairman, I think we should act on the amendment and then
The
bill as amended.
Do you have an amendment, Senator Thomas, with respect to accepting Amendment Number 1?
I would move that we accept Amendment Number 1 to Senate Bill 84.
Any objection? Seeing no objection, that is approved, and now we then have Senate Bill 84 as amended by Amendment Number 1. Senator Thomas.
I would move that we pass Senate Bill 84 as amended to the next committee of referral with the individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Yes.
I don't think we have a CS.
You don't have a CS?
No. Okay. No. This one is just...
I think it's just...
Any objections, then, to the passing through of Senate Bill 84 as amended by Amendment Number 1, passing through to the next committee? Seeing none, we'll have a brief at ease, and we can sign that. So we'll just have a brief at ease. Order, and we now have before us Senate Bill 23, and we've had a number of meetings on this Senate bill prior to today, so we're continuing with that, and the bill sponsor and staff are present, and I understand that there's a CS that we intend upon bringing before the committee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee take up CS for Senate Bill number 23 /P. Is that is the proper working draft, is it not?
It's /P.
/P.
Okay.
The one I'm looking at.
Any objections to bringing the committee substitute for Senate Bill 23 /P before the committee? Seeing none, we are now have before us the committee substitute. Would the bill sponsor or and staff care to comment upon that?
Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Senator Kim Elton from District B, Juneau. And we volunteered to describe for the committee substitute. I use volunteered kind of loosely because Jesse didn't have an opportunity to volunteer as we presented the committee substitute. Relatively straightforward. He'll go through kind of the mechanics of it. In essence, what your committee substitute does is adopt the approach that was suggested by one of your professional testifiers, Mr. Michael Lamb from Fairbanks. So it incorporates his suggestion on allowing those potential employees who come into the system and who already are vested in a defined benefit system. Defined benefit system exclusive of Social Security. It allows them to choose a DC plan, the existing DC plan that the state now has. And with that conceptual description of what your committee substitute does, I'm going to turn it over to my staff to talk about the details.
Yes, Senator Elton, please. We have a question by Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Just a clarification for me. You said that one could choose a defined benefit or defined contribution if they were exclusive of Social Security. It's my understanding that someone who has worked in the private sector and qualifies their 40 quarters for Social Security and then comes to work for the state, are you saying then they could not use the defined contribution?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, no. It was my imprecise language. What I was trying to suggest is that if somebody came with a defined contribution vested or with a defined contribution plan and Social Security, that the Social Security would not be defined for this purpose as a defined benefit.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Elton. Please identify yourself and state your affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Kim Elton. Mr. Chairman, is it your intention that I go through the CS section by section or provide just a little additional detail beyond what Senator Elton discussed?
I believe it'd be appropriate because of the document and the importance of it. Try to go through it as completely as possible in whatever logical order you deem most appropriate.
I'm happy to do so, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. to begin conceptually, just a little bit more, the biggest single change in your CS, Mr. Chairman, is that the repealer section got a whole lot shorter. We will maintain, a good 45 pages of statutes on the books that otherwise would have been repealed. And those are the bulk of the statutes making up the defined contribution retirement plan into which new teachers and public employees are presently hired. to discuss perhaps in a little more detail the sections of the bill, there are a number of sections that simply do some technical cleanup. Sections, I'll list them, 1, 2, 5, 7, and 10, all have the same general impact in that they either amend an existing statute or they simply repeal and reenact it to clarify that somebody who's in the defined benefit plan, or rather the defined benefit plan statutes, do not apply to anybody who is in one of Alaska's defined contribution retirement plans. And that's a two-way street, Mr. Chairman. Quite simply, those sections are technical and they're there to make sure nobody is running down both roads at the same time. The more substantive sections of the bill, you will find at sections 3 and 4, they are unchanged from the original version. As described when the bill was originally presented to the committee 2-3 weeks ago, these repeal the requirement that before a defined benefit pension payment can be fully inflation adjusted, the funds must be 105% funded. They also shift the responsibility to make a decision whether to grant one of those inflation adjustments from the plan administrator to the Alaska Retirement Management Board, which has on it investment experts and several members who are not members of either PERS or TERS. So that disassociated. That is not a change in the CS. if you look, Mr. Chairman, at Section 6 of the bill, which is on page 3, you will find that it almost perfectly mirrors Section 11. The Section 6 is in the teacher's retirement system, the later section in PERS. It governs who, what new employees, what new hires are permitted under your CS to choose the defined contribution retirement plan. As Senator Elton mentioned, those are new employees, hires new to either PERS or TERS, who are fully vested in a defined benefit system other than PERS and TERS. The best example I can think of, Mr. Chairman, is a military retiree, someone who served our nation 20 years, someone who, in the excellent example Mr. Lamb presented, a municipality wants to attract. They don't have a lot of training. These people are highly qualified. They, you know, a municipality or a public employer might know exactly what they want them to do and want to bring them in. That person already has a defined benefit pension. They have retirement security, retirement health care. Mr. Lamb and some other public employers felt that for those, that discrete class of individuals, having a defined contribution plan might actually help public employers recruit, might provide them a significant advantage. And so that is, in essence, who is allowed to opt into the defined contribution plan. There are some mechanical rules. The choice to opt into the DC plan must be made within 60 days. Before the choice is made, the employee must be provided some calculations and information, and that must be provided to them as a deadline, I think, within five days of hire, et cetera. The only other change, Mr. Chairman, I believe in your CS, is found in the repealer section, which is Section 12. You'll find it at page 7, line 15, and I sincerely hope I remember this correctly. It repeals two sections of session law. They are delayed implementation sections. They're not yet in effect. They're scheduled to go into effect in 2010. And what they provide, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to check my notes to make sure I've got this right, is that an employee who refunded their contributions from the defined benefit system, who returns to work after, I believe it is July, on or after July 1, 2010, these sections would have provided that under no circumstance can that person participate in the defined benefit plan. They are in DC and DC only. By repealing those sections, I want to make very clear, Mr. Chairman, your CS does not give those employees an opportunity to buy back their time. That June 30, 2010 deadline that was part of Senate Bill 141 remains to buy back the time. However, if somebody in that category comes back to work for a public employer or a school district, they may participate functionally as a brand new employee in the defined benefit system. They're starting from their first week of credit. They're on year one. They're a brand new employee. They're not going to be tier one. But they would be allowed to begin anew in the DB system. Mr. Chairman, I apologize for the drag there and the details. Those are the changes in your committee substitute. I'm happy to take any questions.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. You could share with me the thought process that went beyond excluding those who have Social Security as qualifying for a defined benefit. We had testimony earlier here that, you know, Social Security is more than retirement. It's disability income. It's a lot of things. One of the reasons it's probably going to collapse, but it's a lot of things. Have you chosen to exclude that as a defined benefit because it's going to collapse, or was there some other thought?
Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Bundy's question, Senator Bundy, the two primary thoughts underlying that decision in the committee substitute, as I understand it, were the government pension offset and windfall elimination provisions, if I remember GPO and WEP correctly, which dramatically reduce what Social Security will pay someone who has a defined benefit pension. That's one. And the second is the availability of defined benefit health coverage. which Social Security does not, as I understand it, provide. And so those significant differences, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bundy, were why Social Security was selected to be treated not as a defined benefit pension for purposes of this choice.
Okay. If I might, Mr. Chairman, I understand that. I would disagree only in that as personal experience of someone who is qualified for Social Security, it's not a dramatic decrease. It's a decrease, and you might question unfairly, but it's not a dramatic decrease in the amount of Social Security that you will receive.
Any further questions of Mr. Keel? I guess to the Senator Elton, is it your belief that then this committee substitute advances a sound public policy by returning to the defined benefit system except for the discrete class of person that is already fully vested, for example, in a military retirement?
Mr. Chair, if you're going to keep asking tough questions like that, I mean, I'll just suggest to the presiding officer we send my bills elsewhere. Having said that, I think that one of the challenges, especially on something of this import, and we went through this before when in 2005 when we went to a defined contribution. I mean, a huge discussion on what a perfect plan is. And I appreciate the fact that I presented to your committee what my version of perfect was. I appreciate the work that this committee put into the effort that I made. And I appreciate the fact that based upon expert testimony, the committee found that this would be an appropriate committee substitute. And that is a very long way of saying thank you for the work you put into it, but also to suggest I don't think the changes that you've made at the committee are toxic to the bill. And again, I would just say there are 60 legislators and there are probably 80 different versions of perfect. And the bill that you have in front of you, I think, goes an awful long way to solving the recruitment retention issues that we're beginning to see with the solely defined contribution approach.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Elton. And Senator Davis?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to know if there's anybody here from the division to speak to the CS. I trust what you said is correct, and I appreciate the overview that you gave. I just want to hear what department, division, or have anything to say about this. Do they agree with everything that's been said?
We have, I believe, Mr. Shire and Mr. Brooks that are here, and they are prepared to discuss this committee substitute. So if
they're going to do that?
Yes.
Okay.
So we intend to. Thank you very much, Senator Elton and Mr. Keel.
Thank you. And both of us will remain in case you need us back. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We would call then, who prefers to Mr. Frank Richards or Mr. Pat Shire? Either whomever is. Kevin Brooks. Yeah. What did I say? Richards? Kevin Brooks. Yeah. There we go. Sorry about that. Misspeaking.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. And as I looked around for Frank Richards, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Transportation, I didn't see him coming, so.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, first, we would also like to thank you for your diligence in working through this bill and the public hearings you've held, and also your patience in allowing us to work with the actuaries and really get to some defensible numbers that we could bring before the committee and really talk to the impacts. As we've done that, the administration and the Department of Administration, we have not taken a position on the bill, and I want to be clear about that. Our focus has been up until this time, what's it cost and what does it do, and then make a briefing to the governor's office and then come back as the bill moves through the process with a definitive position on the bill. I can speak to the CS first, or I had a couple other comments that I had that I'd like to make, and then if you would like some explanation of the fiscal note, I'm happy to do that. So I don't know what the pleasure is of the committee.
Mr. Brooks, please proceed in the manner you feel most comfortable, and Mr. Shire, if you feel like jumping in any time, we welcome your assistance in this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would say, one, we just got a look at the CS ourselves and picked it up on the table. I did get a summary of that over the noon hour and have been looking at it since then. But a couple things that do come to mind, and we will need to go back and really kind of do a more thorough analysis on it and then talk to the sponsor staff. Because I heard what the intent was, and I just want to be clear as we read through it and have a clear understanding. But two things I'd like to point out. When you open, what we've done now is we've gone from having going back to the old DB plan, tier three for PERS and tier two for TERS, to having a choice. When you open up a choice for people, it does create a dynamic with the actuaries, because certain people in certain age groups will pick one over another. And one of the other things we found is as we analyze normal cost, the cost that's required to contribute to accrue enough money to pay a benefit earned, the normal costs for a 25-year-old out of college are very small, and the normal costs for someone my age or maybe even a little older than myself are quite higher because of your life expectancy and all the things that go into that. So the normal costs that the actuaries give us is a composite of that, but every individual in the analysis has their own rate. And so there can be what the actuary terms adverse selection. Younger people will pick one, older people will pick another, and so you end up with a result that's not one-to-one. And so that change in and of itself will take some actuarial review, I believe. At least we'll run it by the actuaries and see what they have to say about it. The other one was the language, and as I was listening to the explanation of repealing that July 1, 2010 date, that closed the plan. And then I heard testimony that it only opens it if you had you're still starting at square one, and I wasn't quite sure what's meant there, and I'd like to get clarification from the sponsor so that we can ask that question of the actuary, because closing the plan and putting that date on had a very specific impact when the original legislation, SB 141, passed. And so if there's a change to that, and it sounds like there's an attempt to limit what that change might be, we just want to make sure of that. So we'll take the CS back and go through it and certainly be prepared to comment on it as the bill moves forward. But those are my initial reactions to it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brooks. I think that's very appropriate to make those comments on that. Senator,
go ahead.
Okay.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, there are just a couple other things that, as I sat and listened to the testimony of the previous two hearings, that I would like to mention and just to provide some clarification. We heard the thing I found with retirement systems and pensions and health care, it's very complicated. And as we work with our actuaries, we've also found that you have to be exceedingly precise with your questions to really get to tease out the answer that we want to do this but not this or whatever the bill says. So and it gets into normal costs and past service costs, and about the third line you see some people the eyes glaze over, and it's really tough, but it is important. And we've heard some mention of other states going back to DB plans. That was a specific thing I heard in previous testimony, that West Virginia and Nebraska have gone back to a DB plan. And we went back and chased that down and found that they have done that for pension only, but they haven't done that for health care. And so my only comment to the committee, and as other folks contemplate these changes, is be precise in the questions you're asking and in the comparisons that you're making, because what may seem apparent may not be. And so in the case of these two, they did go back to a DB pension, and we wanted to put that on the record for the committee. We've heard some talk too that the unfunded liability is irrelevant, I think was the one word, as far as contemplating what we're doing going forward. But I mean, that's a $7.4 billion liability as of the last valuation, which was based on June 30, 2007 numbers. And we have another valuation coming out, and we also know that market performance and other factors have affected that. So, you know, we, in any analysis we do of pension, I can assure you that we're looking hard at the unfunded liability and what impact there might be on that. And there's some estimates that it's grown over $9 billion now. We don't have a formal report of that. And certainly if you just look at market value of assets, you can arrive at other conclusions. But we look at an actuarial valuation, and the actuaries do a smoothing over 5 years. So no single year gain or loss is really going to have that dramatic of an impact. But the fact of the matter is that the unfunded liability is a huge consideration in anything that we do, and what impact legislation might have on that. I also, you know, I heard a lot of discussion about recruitment and retention, and that's something that the administration has taken very seriously as well. The governor established a work group of a sub-cabinet, if you will, that was created by Administrative Order 237 to look at recruitment and retention. And there's components of that involve pay, and they involve, you know, working conditions, and they involve pension and health care and all those things as well. And, you know, we've negotiated responsible contracts. We passed HB 417 last year that adjusted pay for many non-covered employees. And so we're looking at pay. We're looking at alternate work weeks. And we know that public employers around the state are doing the same because they tell us that they are. So that's an important thing. And, you know, we've heard from some of our hiring managers, well, the new tier has made it more difficult for us to hire people. And I heard that in testimony as well. But what we found with the data is that we have 7,200 active PERS employees in the new tier, in this DC plan. 7,200 out of 36,000 active employees, that's 20%. With the teachers, it's a similar number. We have 2,100 active out of about 11,000 in the TERS system, 19%. So in 30 or 32 months, we've hit 20% of active workers are in these new tiers. So they're being hired. It may be difficult in some areas, but I don't know that the data would support the fact that it's harder across the board. And so we wanted you to have the facts of what the active composition of the tiers was, and get that on the record as well. The demographics of the workforce are also very interesting. You know, we think about pension plans, and we have a 30-year retirement, and I think I may be an anomaly. I'm 48, and I started out of college. You know, I have a lot of years in with the state, and but the average for PERS is 45 years old with 10 years of service, and the average for TERS is 45 years old with just under 12 years of service. And the state of Alaska as an employer, it's somewhere, it's about 45 with 9 years of service. And that's an average. That's young people, that's old people, that's people like me and the new person just walking in off the street. But that demographic, and, you know, maybe it helps us. Are we gonna hire someone out of college and employ them for 30 years or 20 years or 25 years? Or are new workers coming into the workforce gonna work for several employers? I don't have the answer to that question, but I just think as we contemplate pension reform and looking at changes, these are questions that we work on. We talk to our actuaries about it, and we try and put together a hiring, you know, a environment for our workers, for the state as an employer, that's going to attract and retain, you know, the best workers, recognizing that we may not have them for 30 years, but we want to get productive years, you know, out of workers that we can. With that, Mr. Chairman, I can pause and take any questions. I can talk about the fiscal note if you'd like and explain to the members what we have in there.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. My first question would relate to the fiscal note. I assume this does not apply to the CS which you just received. Is that correct?
Through the chair and Senator Bundy, that's correct. This fiscal note is based on the original bill.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, if I might, just to but using that fiscal note to tease it out a little further and explore your unfunded mandate concerns, which I happen to share, employer rates, you indicate in the fiscal note, are capped at 22%, so that it is likely that school districts and municipalities, should this bill pass and their unfunded liability go up, that will be a state responsibility. We will continue to be responsible for everything over 22%.
Through the chair and Senator Bundy, that's accurate. Since the passage of SB 125, the plans, TERS was always a blended plan. PERS is now a blended plan, so the state assumes the liability of anything over 12.56 for TERS and 22%, or yes, 12.56 for TERS and 22% for PERS. Right. And we have appropriations, if I may, Mr. Chairman, for the last several years, you'll find in the appropriation bills a separate appropriations, and I think last year it was about $400 million combined. That's the amount in excess of those rates made on behalf of public employers.
Okay, thank you.
Let the record reflect Senator Meyer has now joined us, and we appreciate that. Anyway, the comment that, for example, when one looks at the fiscal note, for example, 2012, and that's a $16 million fiscal year expenditure, if and I take it that that's kind of the worst case scenario if everyone elected into the DB system. Is that
Mr. Chairman, we did make, as we've articulated in the fiscal analysis, that we made the assumption that all members would transfer. Obviously that not all can, but we had to make the assumption because, you know, the questions just start building. If, well, how many and at what level of pay and what years of service? And so it really was to streamline the preparation, but it recognizes that there would be fewer than all, right. Certainly.
Yeah, and really what I was focusing upon, and I believe that elsewhere in the document it references a 4% wage increase annually as kind of the projection forward. So I think just doing a rough calculation that the gross wage for all categories, PERS and TERS, at that time would be $3 billion, maybe a little over $3 billion, something in that category, plus or minus. And so when one references the $16 million fiscal year 2012 expense, that's in proportion or in relationship to approximately a $3 billion gross payroll.
That's an accurate statement, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Bundy?
Yeah, thank you. I would ask you to take a message back to the commissioner and to wherever it would be appropriate. I'm receiving lots of emails on this subject, as you might imagine, and a number of them are coming from state employees on state computers. Now, when a state worker goes to work for the state, they don't give up the right to address their government. However, I think it's inappropriate that they're using state resources and working on state time to be lobbying legislators. My initial reaction is, if they're as understaffed as they claim they are, maybe they wouldn't be as understaffed if they stuck to business and left lobbying to their off-duty times. But in any case, would you take that message back that that's an inappropriate use of state resources?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bundy, that actually this issue had come up recently in the last couple of weeks, and it was about, it wasn't so much the use of email, but it was employees testifying on legislation, this piece of legislation or any. I mean, we have capital punishment legislation. There's all kinds of legislation that state employees have an opinion about, and we certainly encourage that right of, you know, civic participation. We do ask folks, and the word has gone out that people do it on their own time. They identify themselves like I did today as a representative of the administration, or as I work for the state, but I'm here on my own time. I've taken leave to do it, and so we've endeavored to put that message out, and hopefully you'll see the results of that.
Link, thank you very much. Any further questions other than that? We could move. I'd like to move on to Beth Almeida or Mr. Shire.
Mr. Chairman, if I just may add one thing. When we were talking about recruitment and retention, the division looked at a period of time, 4 years, with the change from DB to DC right in the middle. And we looked at all the people that were brand new public employees in the PERS system who came to work in the PERS system during that prior 2 years as one universe. And the other universe was the number of individuals who came to work for public service under the defined contribution retirement plan for a similar period. Then we tracked those individuals over a period of time. And to date, more individuals that came to work under the DB actually refunded out of the system, took their employee contributions and left on a percentage basis in a similar size universe than did defined contribution retirement plan folks. I think it's an example of why did those people leave? I don't know. We didn't talk to all of them. And to say categorically that that's proof positive that DCR is better than DB, unless we talked to those folks and got some more data, we couldn't make that assertion. So I appreciate the comments that have been made earlier by Mr. Brooks here, that we really want to find the data that will help us arrive at the right decisions, because it has consequences for many years to come.
Mr. Bund, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. Just along those lines, I would encourage you to take a look at studies that have been done within state on teaching, and that's my background and my experience. In the top 10 reasons that people leave teaching, retirement doesn't make the top 10. There's lots of other reasons, including just kind of the hazardous duty pay situation, but retirement doesn't make it.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, I apologize for being late. We were at a press conference with the governor. If I understand the CS correctly, and I think the sponsor is still here, so I can ask a question of him as well. But it appears like the CS makes it optional. Either you can go in the Tier 3 or Tier 4, and it almost sounds like you're not sure that the defined contribution has been all that bad as far as recruitment and retention, whereas others, say that we need to go back to the defined benefit. So with that, not really knowing all the complexities and reasons why people come to work and don't come to work, why they leave, don't leave, are you supportive of this CS?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, and we had testified briefly on this point that we have just looked at it too. There are some factors that play into an actuarial analysis of what it means to have two systems open versus one or the other. You get adverse selection on some age. People choose one over another depending on how old they are and what their own personal demographic is. So we want to go back and we just got it too. We want to go back and look at it and understand what the sponsor's trying to accomplish with it. It sounds like it's a pretty narrow focus in addressing a specific thing and then be able to come back and comment on it.
Follow?
Yes.
Okay. Did you support the original bill before the CS?
We did not take a position on the bill, Senator Meyer. We've been spending our time analyzing the cost. Now that we have them, we've just been putting that together. We're going to arrange to brief the governor's office on the implications of the bill so that they have the same information that you're looking at and then come back with a definitive position as the bill moves forward.
Okay. I think it would be good to know the administration's position on this as the bill progresses, because there's obviously a lot of people put a lot of time and effort into this, as well as the legislators.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just thinking about that that for a minute, the idea of the defined benefit plan was in existence for I forget how many years, but a long time, and then then there was an introduction, and I think it was about a month's time that the defined contribution plan replaced the defined benefit plan. Is that correct in the legislature that was done?
through the chair and Senator Thomas, the actual implementation of the new tier was a year later. I mean, the effective date of the program was a delayed effective date of 1 year.
Right. I'm talking about the time frame for the consideration of by the administration. Maybe it was longer. I guess I'm getting at how much time was taken in preparation for a bill being introduced that changed from the DB to the DC plan.
And through the chair, Senator Thomas, as I recall, you know, this has been several years back, there were, you know, it was, I heard that comment too, that it went through the Senate in 1 month. But I think the deliberation on that piece of legislation was far longer than that. But I'd have to go back and get, I think it's a matter of record. We could certainly provide the information, but it.
Senator Thomas?
Well, the only reason I bring it up is I recall when I first came here, I asked people that should have been in the know at the time for the statistics on the tiers of the plan, and specifically on tier three of PERS and tier two of TERS, and the information wasn't available. They could not tell me how the plan had struggled and how much money it had lost and how that compared and that type of thing. It was just a fair amount of supposition, and of course that was due to the a lot of it in my mind was the financial situation that took place in 2001-2002. Obviously great losses, similar to what we're suffering at this point in time, very similar kind of, maybe this one even a little more severe, I'm not sure. But the point, I guess, is, and I'm not sure if it's productive to go back and take a look at that, but I was concerned that the responses that I got at the time, you know, as to what kind of studies had been done, and then the references to the mistakes made by the actuarial firm. So hopefully we have somebody else taking a look at this. Anyhow, it's more of a comment than a question, you know, and it all surrounds the timing of things and the reaction and how quickly it may or may not have been done. And I'm sure people were looking at it for a longer period of time, but it didn't seem that the documentation was substantiated as far as why we changed and whether that made sense. And now we've got at least some short period of time, a little bit longer than what I surmised took place before. But anyhow, it's more or less, like I said, a comment rather than a question.
Any further questions of the committee? I believe Senator Elton wanted to respond or make a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Yes, and Mr. Shire, thank you to both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Senator Kim Elton, District B. And I appreciated the opportunity to be here during the presentation by the department. Just wanted to make a couple of points. And I brought with me again staff member Jesse Keel, who is prepared to talk a little bit about the fiscal note, because I may he was in on a direct meeting with the department about noontime. And I felt compelled to mention a couple of things about the fiscal note. I mean, our understanding is that at that meeting, there were questions asked about, and I guess you have a fiscal note in front of you, that there were questions asked at that meeting that got straight to some assumptions. And some of those assumptions seemed to have been validated by the department. They were going to go back and rework the numbers. But I would just like to point out for the committee that a couple of the assumptions, one of them was about unfunded liability, and that the assumption that was made, which was a different kind of an assumption that had been made in the bill, that could have the effect of lowering the fiscal note by $15 million. In another, the TERS costs, the assumptions made, which seemed to be different than the assumptions made by the actuary, could be a $13 million a year assumption. And so I was a little bit surprised to hear that you had a fiscal note, because my understanding of that conversation had been that they were going to rework the fiscal note. And while I'm talking about the fiscal note, I hope the chair and the committee will allow me to vent just a little bit. We shared this bill as a pre-file with the department. You have gone through three hearings on this bill with an extensive amount of public testimony. And I guess I would have assumed that what would happen is the department would have a fiscal note that they were comfortable with and weren't telling us just an hour ago that, well, wait a minute, we're going to go back and we're going to review our assumptions. I can tell you, as a person who was here in 2005, it didn't take them that long to do a fiscal note for defined contribution. And that was without an awful lot of the data. And that was back when, and I'm going to repeat some words that I heard in the previous testimony, before we even knew what kind of precise questions to ask. So I can understand. I'm not sure you're as frustrated as I am about the lack of a fiscal note.
Senator Elton, we may be able to move the bill with the wish of the committee, possibly with a forthcoming fiscal note if, you know, because I think the numbers are changing and some things are literally the ink is still a little wet.
Right.
So
I would also note that the fiscal note that's prepared, maybe the one that comes later, doesn't address some costs. I mean, I think you've heard testimony that it costs $150,000 to train a new police officer. And we, I think you also heard testimony that it costs $15,000 to train a new state employee. And I think that's an important question. And I will concur with previous testimony that we don't have data on recruitment and retention. We didn't have data on recruitment and retention in 2005 either. But certain assumptions were made in 2005 that led to the very narrow passage of a defined contribution bill. I think that the advantage that you have and that we have now 4 years later is I'm surprised there still is no data, quite frankly. But in the lack of data, I think that the anecdotal testimony that you've heard from public employees and public and people who are public employee hirers, I think that in the lack of data ought to be compelling to a certain extent. And I would just suggest that that yes, data is important. We have more data for this plan than we do on the previous plan. So the final point I want to make, Mr. Chair, is that we heard the unfunded liability issue raised, the size and the growth of the unfunded liability. That's the same kind of testimony that we heard previously 4 years ago. I think I really appreciated the comments that you have to ask precise questions, because no place did I hear an answer to whether or not Tier 4 PERS contributes or lessens the unfunded liability. Nowhere did I hear that Tier 3 PERS does one or the other, or that Tier 2 in TERS or Tier 3 in TERS, what effect it has on the unfunded liability. All the testimony said is that we have an unfunded liability and it's growing. And you've had previous testimony to this committee, especially from experts like Mr. Lamb and from Fairbanks, that has suggested that you can talk about the size of the unfunded liability, but that expert testimony has suggested, nay, said that the unfunded liability isn't growing or decreasing because of it would not grow or decrease because of a switch back to the DB. And I just wanted to point that out and remind the committee. And I appreciate the latitude that the chair and the committee has given me, and I'm willing to answer any questions on what my response here has.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Elton. And again, I apologize for not being here earlier when you went through the CS and the changes, but if I understand, the basic changes are that it's optional, the Tier 3 or 4, if you already have a retirement program that you're invested in. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. It's much more discreet than that. A new employee who is being hired by a public employer, if they have this is the Michael Lamb approach, if they have a defined benefit plan, then they can have the option of selecting a defined contribution. And so it's the choice is to a discrete number of employees or potential employees. my staff member had noted that maybe the easiest example is somebody who comes in with 20 years in the military and has a defined benefit plan would be allowed the option of choosing a defined contribution. I would just suggest, too, and I think it's important to note, you've heard testimony now that, well, that kind of complicates the actuarial because of adverse selection, because you've got young and old and they're going to be selecting different plans. It's not quite that complicated, because I would suggest that there isn't a 24-year-old that's going to be hired by a public employer that's going to have the choice of a defined contribution. They won't have that defined benefit.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. If I may, then I'd just like to ask, why are you limiting those options? In other words, why don't you just make it a choice between anybody, whether it's your first year out of college or first year out of high school, if you want to go to defined contribution or defined benefit? I mean, if you're first year out of college, maybe you feel like you can invest your money better than the state can, or maybe you think or maybe you're going to be a college professor and you only plan on staying put for 5 years, and so you don't want to be tied here for 10 years to get to retirement.
Through the chair, I mean, that's a good question, and again, I mean, I think my perfect plan is different than the perfect plans of 59 of my colleagues, and so when I wrote the bill, there were two things that were compelling to me. One is that the defined contribution plans, I mean, study after study has shown they've been hammered much more heavily in this kind of market condition than have the defined benefit plans. And I may be misremembering the numbers, but in the neighborhood of a 36% hit on defined contribution plans as 22 or 23% hit on defined benefit plans, which kind of begs a question, and maybe I'm anticipating a follow-up here. There are some bright young people that I am absolutely convinced may be able to handle a defined contribution plan over a long period of time, and I don't disagree with that. I would just say that there probably isn't a perfect recipe on how you do it to protect all future retirees. And having said that, I'd just perhaps extend my comment in one more way. With some of you, I serve on the Finance Committee, and we recently had testimony from Michael O'Leary, who is with Callan Associates. I mean, that's his business, his investment kinds of stuff. And I was sitting there wondering, one of the problems with the defined contribution is the defined contribution is especially vulnerable in times like these when the market tanks. And I was sitting listening to Mr. O'Leary, and I was thinking to myself, if he has a defined contribution plan, he's probably sitting there wondering how many more years he's going to have to work to get to the retirement that he thought he would have. So that's another element of that. And finally, I would just say, this is a lengthy answer to a very good question. And finally, I would say that I think that a bright young person who is capable of doing that will be doing it outside of their retirement system also, and in a way that will take the defined benefit retirement and make it even better.
What I'd like to do, I have invited testimony from an individual in Washington, D.C. that's been holding on, and so I
part of this is my problem, Mr. Chair, answering in such a way.
If I could just do one quick follow-up.
Quick,
follow-up.
Yes,
and that is just, first of all, I want to say I like the CS. I think you've come a long ways as far as meeting my concerns. But what we heard consistently is that we need more tools for recruiting these bright young people that you're talking about, and I'm just thinking, why not at least have that option to recruit these bright kids that you're talking about by offering both programs? It's just something to think about, and I just wanted to ask if you had.
And very quickly, I think you may be right. Intuitively, I think you are right that it will marginally help on recruitment. The bigger concern that I have is retention. Because you heard testimony that employees that are in the defined benefit are now leaving and taking the money they put in And the problem with defined contribution is they can leave with the money they put in and that the employer put in. So I think retention is probably the important component.
Good.
Thank you.
My only comment is I hope we can hire that bright young person and have them do it for the rest of us. So anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would like now to move immediately to Beth Almeida, and hopefully you are still online.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and hopefully you've been following. And what I'd like for you to do is please identify yourself and state your affiliation, and please begin your presentation.
Good. Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Paskin. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here this afternoon, and members of the committee. My name is Beth Almeida. I'm the executive director of the National Institute on Retirement Security. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization based here in Washington that does research on retirement issues. And I'm really pleased to have this opportunity this afternoon to speak with you about the findings of an important analysis, a report that we actually released earlier today, so it's hot off the presses, if you will. And it's the title of the report is Pensionomics, Measuring the Economic Impact of State and Local Pension Plans. And I'd be very happy to delve into some of the national findings as well as the state-level findings if you would like me to do that at this point.
Yeah, we have the handout that I believe that you have provided to us, and so we have that. So we, if you would like to follow that, please do.
Sure.
If there's some other method, you know, what's most comfortable to you?
I think that makes a lot of sense. So the document you're referring to is the PowerPoint presentation?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Very good. Well, let me just jump right in and talk about why we wanted to do this study. What we were really interested in taking a look at was measuring the economic footprint, if you will, of state and local pension plans, both nationally across the United States and also within states. And the reason why we were really interested in this and why we think it's a very timely analysis is that economists generally recognize that defined benefit plans, traditional pensions, act as an automatic stabilizer in the economy. And what we mean by that is that even in tough times, even in an economic downturn like the one that we're experiencing at the moment, retirees who have a stable, reliable pension can maintain their spending on basic needs, even regardless of what's happening in the stock market. And that actually has stabilizing effects on the national economy. And so what we wanted to do was really get a sense of how much of a stabilizing effect pensions might have on the U.S. economy and also on state economies. And the reason we focused on state and local pensions for this particular study really had to do with the availability of data. The Census Bureau publishes data on state and local pension plans that is fairly detailed at the state level. So that's why we chose to look at that, although certainly private sector defined benefit plans would have similar properties, similar macroeconomic effects. So to just kind of give you the high-level findings of what we found, and I'll be happy to talk about these in more detail a little bit further on, but if you look at slide number 4 in the presentation, nationally we found that expenditures made out of state and local retirement benefits supported about 2.5 million jobs in the U.S. Those are American jobs, which paid about $92 billion in income to American workers, wages, salaries, benefits. State and local pension plans had a total economic impact of about $358 billion, and they supported about $57 billion in tax revenue at the federal, state, and local levels. Now, in terms of what we found with respect to the impact of state and local pension plans in Alaska, if you flip to slide 5, you'll see some of the high-level findings there. According to the analysis that we conducted, expenditures that were made out of state and local retirement benefits there in Alaska supported about almost 6,300 jobs within the state of Alaska, that paid about $385 million in income. Now, just to give you a sense of you know, how many jobs that is. That's more Alaskans that are employed in, say, the seafood processing industry or even in the oil and gas industry directly in the state. State and local retirement benefits and the expenditures made out of those benefits supported about $1 billion in economic impact statewide and about $155 million in federal, state, and local tax revenue. So, and if you flip to slide six, you'll see there sort of a little picture of dollar bills. And what that's intended to help represent is, you know, sometimes when you're looking at these, you know, millions and billions dollars numbers, it gets a little bit, you know, the numbers get kind of big. And as senators, I know that you're used to dealing with big numbers and budget numbers and things like that. But we wanted to sort of translate into, you know, for $1 in pension benefits paid out, what does that translate into in terms of overall economic effect? And again, according to our analysis, for each dollar that was paid out in benefits to Alaska retirees, the Alaska economy saw an economic impact of $1.25 in terms of total economic activity that was supported in the state. And flipping to slide seven, what this indicates is a similar concept but expressed a little bit differently. Here, what we were really interested in getting at was for each dollar that taxpayers contribute to state and local retirement systems, what is the ultimate economic impact of that? And here we found that a dollar contributed by Alaska taxpayers to state and local pensions supported about $6.35 in total economic activity in the state. So those are sort of the high-level findings, and if it would be appropriate, I'd be happy to talk a little bit more about the methodology that we used, how we arrived at these numbers, and then, of course, to, you know, answer any questions that you might have about this. So flipping to slide eight, you'll see just some high-level descriptive statistics, if you will, on state and local traditional pensions, DB plans, in Alaska. And according to the Census Bureau data that we were using, and again, that was the primary data source that we used for the study, close to 35,000 Alaskans received pension benefits from state and local pensions in 2006. 2006 was the most recent year available for this data set, and that was the data that we used for this analysis. Retired Alaskans received roughly $819 million in benefit payments in 2006, and the average pension was fairly modest. It was about $1,900.53 a month, or about $23,000 a year. And again, given that most of the folks up there in Alaska who are receiving these benefits are not receiving Social Security benefits, these really are the benefits that folks rely on to meet those day-to-day expenses. In terms of the financing of state and local plans, again, as you all are aware, this is a shared responsibility model. What we did was we looked at the census data to get a sense of over a long period of time, and in this particular data source, the data goes back to 1993. So we wanted to take a look at where does the money come from to finance these systems, and what we found, again, based on the census data, was that over that 13-year period, investment earnings and employee contributions were really kind of doing the lion's share of the work, if you will, of financing retirement benefits. Investment earnings accounted for about 70% of system revenues, employee contributions about 12.5%, and employer contributions or taxpayer contributions were responsible for the remaining portion of about 18%. Now, how do pension plans have these economic impacts? Well, if you flip to slide 10, you know, what we talk about here is the fact that pension plans can have economic impacts through several different channels. For instance, through a benefit channel. The benefit channel would be when retirees receive benefits and they go out and spend these benefits in the local economy. That, by virtue of that expenditure, other folks in that local economy receive incomes. And so that's what we mean when we talk about the benefit channel. Pension plans also have economic impacts through their investment activities, and here we call that the investment channel. The investment, and here what we're talking about is the fact that the assets which are in a pension trust are invested, and that through those investments, businesses are provided capital to develop new products, new technologies, and create jobs. So that is a very important way that pension plans have economic impacts. However, I want to make clear at the outset that this study really does focus on the benefit channel, that pension expenditure channel, rather than the investment channel. If you flip to the following slide, it's slide 11, this gives a little bit of a greater detail about how that benefit channel works. And it really illustrates what economists call an economic multiplier effect. So in this case, you'll see, you know, a flow chart, an illustration that shows a retired school teacher who uses her pension check and her pension money to buy a car. Now, when she buys that car, as a result of that purchase, the car dealership that she's purchasing that automobile from immediately sees an economic benefit from that. The salesman, the owner of the dealership, all receive a benefit from that. And that's what we call a direct impact of that expenditure. But when the ownership of the owner of the dealership or the salesman receive that income, they in turn can go out and spend that new income that they have. That's what we call the indirect impacts of that initial expenditure that the retiree made. And when those you know salespersons and the owners of the car dealerships you know go and expend their income, there's also a third impact, which is an induced impact, and this happens when the companies that were involved with the production of the car hire additional employees to replenish their inventories as a result of that increased business. And those employees who had been hired as a result of that purchase go out and spend their paychecks in the local economy. So this is, again, what economists refer to as a multiplier effect, and it really sort of describes how an initial economic event, the initial spending of a pension benefit, sort of ripples through an economy. So what we did to really measure the size of that ripple effect was we started out, again, as I said before, using census data. If you look at page 12, we sort of outline the basics of the methodology involved with the study. We started with benefit payment data from the United States Census Bureau's State and Local Government Employee Retirement System Survey. This is an annual survey that they publish that provides data on pension benefit payments, system revenues for all of the 50 states and also at the national level.
Ms. Almeida, if we could ask that you focus on, so to speak, the conclusions. You know, I think we understand the census data and that, but we're running a little short on time, and I do appreciate your participation, but...
Absolutely. No worries. If you did have detailed questions about the methodology, you could feel free to ask that in the Q&A. But I'll jump right to the punchline. Essentially, what we did was, you know, using that census data and an economic impact modeling software called Implan, we were able to estimate the economic impacts of the benefit payments, both nationally and within the state of Alaska. So if we jump to the results on page 14, on slide 14, what you'll see is that the expenditures that were made out of these benefit payments supported about 6,270 jobs statewide that paid about $385 million in income to residents in the state of Alaska. These benefits supported about $1 billion in economic output statewide and about $155 million in federal, state, and local tax revenues. In terms of how this breaks down, the next several slides will provide additional detail on these results. Turning to slide 15, you'll see that the total economic impact of $1 billion can be broken down into those direct impacts, those indirect impacts, and the induced impacts, as we talked about in the flow chart a few slides back. Flipping to slide 16, you'll see the tax revenue impacts broken down into their federal, state, and local, and other corporate tax categories. you'll see that the $155 million tax impact was fairly evenly divided between federal taxes paid out of pension benefits and also federal taxes that resulted from those expenditures of $87.5 million, state and local tax revenues of $67.8 million, and other corporate taxes of about $0.2 million, or about $200,000. And I should note that these are all annual figures. These are all these estimated impacts are all sort of what the impact is in 1 year within the state of Alaska, or in the national economy in the case of the national results. Flipping to slide 17, just to give you a little bit of flavor about the industries where the most significant economic impacts were felt. Healthcare and social assistance, 1,300 jobs, a little bit north of 1,300 jobs, and about $119 million in total economic impact. Retail trade, about 1,300 jobs, and about $97 million in total economic impact. Accommodation and food services was another high employment impact industry, about 839 jobs. And in terms of the top three slot for the economic impact ranking, we saw the third largest industry was real estate and rental and leasing with $51 billion. On slide 18, you'll see more detailed economic impacts by industry. And here we present sort of the top 10 industries where the top 10 largest economic impacts were felt. Turning to slide 19, here you'll see, again, the numbers that I presented right at the outset in terms of that expenditure multiplier. Again, what this measurement tells us is what is the total economic impact of each dollar that gets paid out in retirement benefits, and how does that ripple through the economy? So as illustrated on page 19, a dollar in retirement benefits paid out results in about $1.25 in total economic activity. And turning to slide 20, the taxpayer contribution factor. Again, what this tells us really is sort of, you know, what is the return, if you will, on each dollar that taxpayers are investing in these pension plans. And again, remember when we talked through that slide that illustrated the sources of contributions to the retirement systems, and you'll remember that it was employee contributions and investment earnings that were really kind of doing the lion's share of the work of financing those benefits. So here what you find is that taxpayer contribution factor is quite significant. So for each dollar contributed by taxpayers, you get a total economic impact of $6.35. So what did we conclude from this analysis? Well, turning to slide 21, just a few of the takeaways, if you will. First is that state and local pension plans have a large economic footprint, both nationally and within your state of Alaska. State and local pensions have significant ripple effects. You know, we often, especially in these difficult economic times, focus on the costs of the different items in the state budget or even nationally. But what's important to also remember is that there are benefits that are getting paid out, and that those do ripple through the economy, and other residents of the state benefit as one retiree spending becomes another person's income within the local community. State and local pension plans do have sizable multipliers. The upfront investment of a taxpayer dollar goes a long way thanks to the importance of investment returns, and also the fact that employees are doing part of the job of financing these benefits, and that's important to recognize. So, you know, if you turn to page 22 or slide 22, we think that an important takeaway is that is to recognize that state and local pensions really do provide do more than just providing income to retirees, although that's certainly their primary job and that's their most important job for about 7.3 million retired Americans and about 35,000 retired Alaskans. These pension benefits support about 2.5 million American jobs and about $358 billion in economic activity at the national level across the United States. And within your state, we estimate that the economic impacts are significant, that these pension and retirement benefits support 6,200 Alaskan jobs and about $1 billion in economic activity. And finally, I think one of the most important things to remember or things to keep in mind, you know, with respect to this study is that is a point that often gets lost. You know, we often have this discussion about defined contribution, defined benefit, and you know, the relative merits of either system, and there are pros and cons certainly of either system. But one of the important but yet under-recognized aspects of defined benefit plans is really their role as automatic stabilizers. And what I mean by that, again, is, you know, economists have long recognized that because retirees who are getting that steady, reliable pension check can count on that, can budget on that, in difficult times like this, they don't have to look at their 401k statement, their balance, or check the ticker before they go out to the grocery store or go to the pharmacy. They can, you know, spend on those basic needs that they need to meet their daily family needs without having to worry about, you know, the extreme ups and downs, if you will, of financial markets. And that is not just good for retirees. It is good for retirees, and that's an important thing to recognize. But it actually turns out that that's good for the economy as well, because what that means is that instead of ratcheting back spending and contributing to the overall economic contraction that we're in, retirees who are able to count on steady defined benefits are actually able to just kind of continue chugging along. And again, so that's not just good for them, but that's good for when they go to that pharmacy, the pharmacy owner or the person behind the counter. That's good for the person at the local diner. And that steady spending actually helps others in the community as well. So those are sort of the top-line findings, if you will. And I think we also provided a two-page fact sheet that has Alaska Pensionomics measuring the economic impact of state and local pension plans. I'm not sure if that was distributed to the committee, but if it was, that's just sort of a two-pager that highlights or summarizes the findings that I presented in detail in the PowerPoint presentation. I hope that I was
We have one question
somewhat
for you.
Clear. It's hard a little bit doing this by phone, but I hope that these findings will be helpful in your deliberations, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. We have at least one question. Senator Bundy?
Is this still labor and commerce? No. Thank you. I'm always amazed at the esoteric of information that's available to us on any given subject, and I'm rather flattered. This was awful, a lot of work for a remote state like Alaska. Why did you choose Alaska to study?
Oh, yes, Senator. I should make it clear that this is actually part of a national study that we released earlier today. That is available on our website, and we can certainly make copies available to the committee.
Short answer
should the committee
is
be
fine.
Interested. So what we did in this study was
looked
at all 50 states.
All right.
The economic impact of state and local plans for all 50 states, and also nationally.
I understand it's for
at the
all
national
50
level,
states.
For all of the United States together. So,
Hold on, ma'am.
This is what we did for Alaska, we also did for the other 49.
Okay, I understand it's all 50 states. I'm sure that's a very expensive endeavor. Who paid for it?
We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan research institute. We're funded by a very broad coalition, if you will, or we have a broad membership that includes trade associations, financial service providers, pension plans across the country.
A very broad
membership.
Yes, I understand the people that make their living off pension plans are funding this. Thank you. You pointed out, and I have a question about two questions. One, any dollar that flows through the economy follows your economic multiplier, I assume, is correct. And your, as you pointed out in your chart, investment returns are the largest portion that supports a defined benefit, much larger than worker contributions. With a prolonged down market, is it not possible that the state will end up providing the majority of the defined benefit because the investment returns no longer do it? And so, as I'm a subscriber to the No Free Lunch, the notion that this is a stabilizer is only valid as long as there's money in the account. Otherwise, the dollars that the state would normally spend elsewhere goes into the defined benefit, and it really is not a net gain.
Yes, Senator, thanks very much for that question. If you look, refer back to slide 9 in the presentation, what you'll find is that that period of time over which we were doing that calculation in terms of the relative contributions of investment earnings, taxpayer contributions, and employee contributions to the financing of these retirement systems, you'll note that that period of time, 1993 to 2006, encompasses both up markets and really quite extremely down markets. That period did include the bear market of 2001-2002. So what we're looking at here is over a long period of time, and while it's certainly true that with current economic conditions, pension plans across the country, many of them have experienced losses, as every market participant has. But, you know, one of the benefits, really, of a defined benefit system is the long-term nature and of the pension system itself. So a state-sponsored pension system, or even a local pension system, spans decades, or in some cases even some of these systems have been around for more than a century. And that's really quite different than the timing and planning horizon of an individual who might be in a defined contribution program. So for myself, I've got another 20-30 years or so to save for retirement, and then my retirement will last, hopefully if I'm lucky and live to a ripe old age, another 20 years or so. So that's actually a fairly, in terms of market cycles, that's a fairly short period of time, because what we do know from market cycles is that we can have prolonged bear markets and prolonged bull markets as well. And what defined benefit plans really do allow is for a better time diversification of investment risks, which makes a dollar contributed to a defined benefit program actually go a lot further than a dollar contributed to a defined contribution program, simply because individuals saving on their own, because they don't have the benefit of that enhanced time diversification, have to invest much more conservatively. And in fact, we released a study last summer, which I would commend to the committee in the event that you might find its findings relevant for your deliberations, that sort of did an apples-to-apples comparison, if you will, of defined benefit plans versus defined contribution plans. And again, the goal was to figure out, for a given retirement target retirement benefit, how much would you have to put into a defined benefit system as compared with a defined contribution system to kind of achieve the same target benefit level. And what we found was a pretty substantial difference. And in fact, that the defined contribution system was at a fairly distinct disadvantage for a number of factors, one of which had to do with that time diversification component. When individuals save for retirement, if you've ever met with a financial advisor, what they've probably told you is, as you age, you should become more conservative with your investing.
Ma'am?
Yes.
On behalf of the Labor and Commerce Committee, we do want to thank you. We know that it's 7 p.m. your time, and we do thank you. We know that this study is literally just came out this morning, and I personally thank you for attending on such short notice, and we do thank you for this. And would it be possible if we you might be made available later if that were to be possible?
Absolutely. I'd be thrilled to come back and speak to the committee more.
All right. Thank you very much again, and thank you for participating.
Okay, thank you.
Goodbye.
You'll warn us when that happens.
I'm
going to make you sit through.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that CS for Senate Bill 23, version /P, be moved from Senate Labor and Commerce to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal note.
Any objections, Senator Bundy?
I just object enough to make a comment, if I might. I hate to disappoint Brief, you by letting
we are assuming.
Yes. You know, we've heard a lot. Yeah, we've got the smart young people that don't need this, and maybe I guess it's the slower middle-aged people that do. That might be an odd correct inference, or incorrect inference. And how difficult this state is, I mean, people have not looked at other states where they have the rule of 85, which is far less lucrative retirement than what we have now. And I've heard a lot of conversation about the state workers deserve this. And perhaps they do, but my question will always remain, but at what cost? And I certainly can count the numbers here and understand the bills going forward. I might have objected more, but frankly, I've lost confidence in the Senate Bill 141 sponsor in both his financial judgment and his other judgments. So I will remove my objection to the bill moving forward.
Seeing then no objection to CS for Senate Bill 23 /P, it is now moved out of Labor and Commerce. We close the committee. It's approximately 3:08, and please have everyone sign.